Welcome back. Let us learn today. This morning we are going to be learning, our shir is on the topic of Judaism, nationality or religion, which is, thank you very much to the President of the United States for the topic. And I'd like to first of all just thank our sponsors this morning, to Sharon and Adam Cohen, who are sponsoring for Celia's induction to the IDF today, which is really, where is Adam and Sharon? They are, oh, there we are, on your regular seats. Wonderful. This is an incredible, who could think of a more incredible donation than one's children to being part of Eretz Yisrael and caring for our brothers and sisters, and also upon Adam's, the yortzad of Adam's grandfather, Yosef ben Moshe HaKohen, God willing, his schus should be a schus of Celia and for the whole mishpacha. We also are learning today for the aliyas neshama of Ruth Iglicki's father, Moshe, Mr. Moshe Perlstein, Moshe ben Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen, Olav HaShalom, who was a Holocaust survivor who had the task of raising three children alone. Did a remarkable job, and Emetz Hashem will be a continued Melitz Yosher for you, for the children, for the entire Mishpacha, always. And thank you to Mitch Lauf, who is sponsoring Leila Nishmas, his father, Naftali Tzvi ben Baruch, whose Yartzad is today, by Yom itself. Thank you for being part of this, and Mr. Shem, it should be continued Aliyas Neshama for him and a Chizuk for the whole Mishpacha. So let's start at the very beginning. This is a topic which, the moment I heard this last week in the morning, that the President had announced that had released the latest executive order on combating anti-Semitism, declaring Judaism as a nationality, I was like, wow, that is incredible. The President has taken a stab at one of the most complex sugyas in Jewish thought. And I was very excited to be able to work with him on that topic. Before I go further, just a quick mazel tov to Dr. Steve Kellner on Sarah's engagement last night. Mazel tov, Emetz Hashem, b'shar tova mutzlachas. This is going to be a very, very special simcha. There are more copies coming out. So let's take a look at this. So the executive order is public information. It's not just the picture of him signing it. You can actually read the executive order. And one of the aspects of this order, and of course it's complex, it's not just simply a statement, is to include, if you take a look at this in section 1 over here on page 1, if you do not have it, it's Torah Shabbat, it's fine as well. My administration is committed to combating the rise of anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic incidents in the United States and around the world. Anti-Semitic incidents have increased since 2013, and students in particular continue to face anti-Semitic harassment in schools and university and college campuses. So he quotes the law, Title 6 of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, and national origin in programs and activities receiving federal financial assistance. While Title 6 does not cover discrimination based on religion, individuals who face discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin do not lose protection under Title 6 for also being a member of a group that shares common religious practices. Discrimination against Jews may give rise to a Title 6 violation when the discrimination is based on an individual's race, color, or national origin. So essentially what he is doing is he's including in this Title 6 of the Act of 1964, the Civil Rights Act, is including Jews, essentially, which is a remarkable thing, and it is given rise to a large legal and also hashkafic debate over the last few days. Legally speaking, can you do this? Can you define Jews as a nationality? And hashkafically speaking, what is this all about? So it is interesting. There are a number of articles. I found really an excellent article in the New York Times Opinion, actually, on this topic, and it's interesting that even at the time of the civil rights movement, there was a debate in the wording of Title VI as to whether it did or did not include anti-Semitism. At the time, it was not explicitly worded as such, but there was a debate. There was such a debate as to whether it would include Jews in the first place. That's number one. An example of an interesting episode that happened in 1982 in Shari Tzvil in Silver Spring, which was spray painted with swastikas, and there was the Supreme and Ku Klux Klan symbols. So this case actually went under the plaintiff's side to the Civil Rights Act of 1866, And they brought it to Supreme Court. And interestingly enough, in source one, you take a look over here in the second paragraph, the case ultimately reached the Supreme Court, which voted unanimously in the synagogue's favor. The question before us is not whether the Jews are considered to be a separate race by today's standards, Justice Byron White wrote, but whether at the time the statute was adopted, Jews constituted a group of people that Congress intended to protect. The justices concluded that Jews fell within the statute's scope. Jewish groups cheered the ruling. So this is 1982 already. So what he's saying is that on a legal level, that irrespective of whether the Jews are considered a nationality or not, they were meant to be included in the civil protections of this country. And that's what he's trying to do. He's not trying to change whether they're a nationality or not. He's trying to include them in the intention. The article does actually, as it goes further, bring up some of the issues which are complex in this line of thinking. And that is, the idea of Jewishness as a nationality presents similar problems. The Hebrew Bible speaks of the Jews as the nation of Israel, the holy nation, and Jews across the world share cultural, linguistic, and historical as well as religious bonds. But the notion of a nationhood in the Hebrew Bible and later Jewish thought is not the same as modern conception of nations as territorially bound political entities. Jews do not fit neatly into categories of race, religion, and national origin that took their present shape millennium before the Jewish people came into existence. So what he's pointing out is that it's not so simple just to be able to say, to wave a wand and say, the Jews are a nationality. Well, there's a complex history, a very complex history, certainly across to the backdrop of the milieu of what we call nation states today as well. So the question is from a Jewish perspective, is what's really going on over here? But before doing that, I think that we should just take a step backwards. And I know people like to jump into the debate, and the president is always completely right, always completely wrong. Doesn't seem to be there's much grayscale in this country left right now, right? So, but let's just for a moment just actually say thank you to the president. Thank you, President Trump, for taking the time for issuing an executive order to protect the Jews. That's the first thing we should be saying. Is thank you for acting immediately, unlike many elected officials who did not even issue a statement or tweet. I mean, all we need is 140 characters, folks, right? Just to say that they were distressed by the tragedy that occurred last week when Jews were once again targeted by another hate group. Here we have action. And so the first thing we should be doing is saying thank you to the president. Now, the question is the complexities of application. So how does this work? Well, let's appreciate that. Thank you so much, Mr. Siegel. I'm sorry, the printing was going a little slower today. So here's the perspective. It also should be noted, and as many people do point out, that it does raise some questions, unfortunately, for the state of American Jewry. And that is that it's usually the anti-Semites who use the concept of Jewish nationalism. So in the 1800s, it was the so-called neo-Darwinists who were intent upon saying that the Jews, in fact, were a nation, because then we could fight a war against a nation, wherever it is. So therefore, when the Germans marched through Europe and they went from country to country destroying the Jews there, part of their ideology was the Jews were a nation as well, a race. So there's a danger, there's a very big danger to this dual nationality question which will be raised because of this. Be it as it may, let's understand this from a perspective of a historical perspective. I'd like to shift through a number of steps through Jewish history and try to appreciate this from a larger and greater perspective. So the first thing is where does it all start? Actually start with Adam Arishon, but we're not going to go start with Adam Arishon right now. There seems to be a shift from all of humanity and all of the land down to a Bechir, a chosen human and a chosen land, right? So there seems to be that humanity as a whole forfeited its right to being, so to speak, the acute or specific platform of God's will, and there now became a chosen process where we have an individual who proved himself worthy in his name, or really their names Avram and Sarah. Avram was this pioneer in monotheistic teaching. And we see at the beginning of Parshas Lech Lecha, Vayomer Hashem al Avram, I'm going to take you, and you're going to go to this land I'm going to show you. And what's going to happen? He's told that he's going to become a great nation. His name is going to be made great. The whole point of this exercise is not to foster an individual who's going to be teaching godliness. It's going to be to create a nation, which is going to be a large nation. It's going to have a land. And that's why he's moving towards this land. So the whole point of the starting point seems to be is the creation of, we'll call it, a goy, a nation. And in fact, in the Brisbane Abbasarim, later on in Parshas Lech Lecha, Hashem reiterates this idea to him. So when he talks about the whole process through Egypt, at the end of this, he says, "Bayomahu Hakadosh Baruch Hu says in Perek Tesvav in Source 3, Karas Hashem es Avram es Bris Leimor, Lizaracha nosati es Aretz Azois, Minahar Mitzrayim ad Nahar Gadol, Nahar Pras. You may think you're an individual, but I'm going to give you children." At this point, Avram Avinu does not have children. And he says, "I'm going to make you into a nation. I'm going to give you this land. I'm going to make you, so to speak, into a nation." The word nation is very hard to translate into Hebrew because there's a number of different expressions of this. But it sounds like, from the beginning, that there is a notion of Bereshis, Bishvil, Yisrael, Shenikru, Reshis, Knesset Yisrael, Am Yisrael. There's a notion of the fact that this is going to be a much larger picture, which is going to be unfolded in the future. In fact, when trying to understand this, there's a number of different Balei Machshava we could look at, but one of the preeminent ones that we'll be focusing on this morning is the Kuzari, Rav Yehuda Halevi, who 800 years ago expressed a lot of the ideas, concepts in Jewish philosophy and thought. Here's what he says. Really, really brilliant insight. The Kuzari is a book which is framed as an apocryphal conversation between the Melech Kuzar, this non-Jewish state or king, who's looking to find the truth, and he converses with a number of intellectuals or leaders in thought in different religions, the philosopher, the Christian, the Muslim, and the Jew, the Chaver, the wise man of the Jew. And this is his discussion, and ultimately it's his questioning the Jewish religion. And here's the conversation. It's in paragraph Tzadi Hei. Now, the 95th paragraph, it's a conversation which goes paragraph, paragraph, paragraph. And here's what he says. Achar sheloi haya chol, in page 4, Chola inyan ha'eloki, ki im beyechidim mibnei Adam, achar Adam arishon, ki Adam haya sholem mibiltzi tnai. He says, you know, after Adam was, so to speak, the sum total of all humanity, the corpus of all humanity was included in Adam. And when he sinned, which ultimately was, so to speak, an individualistic crime, it was a crime of self-thought, then what happens is it splinters. And after him, not every individual is going to be the same level as what we'll call the chosen individual was supposed to be, and only parts of his progeny would ultimately be chosen. And he's called the son of God, so to speak. Do we believe in the son of God? Yes, that's Adam. Right, nobody else. Right, nobody else got that title, I'm afraid. That was taken. And therefore he says that those who are his children are called Bnei Elohim, that the children of Adam. V'holid banim rabim, v'loya mehem ro elios b'makam echad ela hevel. There was only one who really had the right space and place, that was Hevel. Ki hoya dom elo, he was the one who was most similar to his father. V'kasher horogor kayin achir b'mnei kinosoi boy ha'al amala azois, and his brother who saw this in him and grew jealous of this, killed him. Nosanlo tachtov sheis, the son who took his place was sheis v'yodom ele Adam. By the way, it's important to understand, therefore, how many children did Adam really have? Not three, but two is what he's saying. His sheis was the replacement, so to speak, almost the yibum of that neshama of Hevel that should have been, that needed to find place. That's the way he understands it. V'yos segula v'olev v'zulosoi k'klipa. He was, in a certain sense, the chosen, the treasured one, the heart. Everything else is like a clipper. A clipper literally means a shell. Kabbalistically means to say it's external. It's not the essence. V'cheni gia inyan ad Noach. And similarly, there was this movement towards Noach 10 generations later. B'yechidim hoyo alavavois domim lo adam v'nikroim b'nei Elohim. Shlemim b'briyosam u'midosam v'arichos hayomim v'chochmos v'yecholes v'imeim hoyo anumonim e'adam ad Noach. So there were certain individuals who walked the earth who were more similar to Adam than others. And we followed that chain along, and of their children, one or two became special, and their children, one or two, and we followed that chain down to reach a person called Noach, and the rest of the world is destroyed. There were children in that chain who weren't exactly mirror images of the chain that they were representing, like Terach. But they skipped a generation. We know how this works sometimes. So Avraham Avinu was, in a certain sense, the DNA matching his grandparents, or his great-grandparents, rather than simply his father.
And
And he goes on to say this, and he talks about his children, his children's children, Yitzhak, Yaakov. And I'd like to start off actually in the line which starts by the word Esav, just a few lines down. Towards the end of the line is a comment. It says, V'nei Yaakov kulam segula. All the children of Yaakov were segula, were chosen, meaning they're the first group of children who were all matching their parent in this way. Kulam ru'im le'in alayki, v'ayolohem ha'makom ahum yuchad binyan alayki. And therefore the place was also special to them. What's the place? The land of Israel. V'zeh yotchilas chul ha'inyan alayki al kahal. And this is the first time that the divine idea now took root on a people, not an individual. Up till now, it was an individual holding that torch. Now the torch turned into a fire. Acharei asher lo haya nimtza kiim b'yichidim. V'yishmerem elokim v'yafreim v'yarbeim v'yagadleim b'mitzrayim. And he put them in Egypt and they grew there. Kasher yugudal ha'ilan asher shor shotov. Like a tree with good roots. Until the tree actually produced its fruit. And who is this? Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, Echov. That was the roots. All the leaders of the generation. And he goes to the next line. And now at this point in time, we're now moving away from the notion of individualism, we'll call it tribalism, and now we move into the notion of nationhood, says the Kuzari. Chosenness moves from individuals who merited it to a nation who deserved it, who represented, who reflected that idea. And he goes on to say, by the way, that doesn't mean to say that every apple is going to be good in that nation. There are going to be apples, you know, in terms of just the splitting up and the distribution. There are going to be those who don't quite match the parents as well. And nonetheless, they're still included in this entity and corpus of called a nation, called Am Yisrael, called Knesset Yisrael. So this is a remarkable idea. In a certain sense, we'll call it humanity take two. Humanity take one was Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava. They lost it. They were individuals who carried the spark of what should have been until the point where they were able to clarify it enough. The Esavs and the Ishmaels of the world were subverted. They were taken out. And now we created this called Shiftei Ka, turning into ultimately Beis Yisrael, which is the way the Torah frames it, which is when the Mishkan comes, the Shekhinah comes down. Then they call Beis Yisrael the end of Shemois. That's when this is achieved. Okay, we'll call it Genesis Part 1, Genesis Part 2. Genesis Part 1 is the tribes. Genesis Part 2 is the nation. That's Bereshit and Shemois, which is why the Bahag calls Sefer Shemois Sefer Hasheni. It's now the creation of, we're moving from the details, the individuals, into the nation, and it's completed when the Shekhinah comes down and rests on the tent as it did on the tents of the Avos as individuals, now on the tent of the nation as a whole. That seems to be the movement. And this, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to the nation of Israel forming. And that's what ultimately it is. We're not going to have the time to do this today, but it is fascinating to read through the Derech Hashem, and perhaps if we have the time to understand Mamneches Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, the Sforna of the point of the nation of Israel. Doesn't mean to say that the rest of the world is chopped liver, it means they're going to try to teach the rest of the world on this platform. Nonetheless, for our point today, for our focus today, our focus is going to be what happened when it didn't work. Meaning to say, yes, we've created, the Hashem has chosen a nation. He has created this nation, which now bears his name, which now lives in the land of Israel. They are called the nation of Israel. And to me, by the way, this is always my pet peeve. Because people say the Jews, the Jews, the Jews. The Jews left Mitzrayim, the Jews entered the land. The Jews never entered the land. There were no such thing as Jews. Jews is an anachronism. The nation of Israel entered the land of Israel. They were called Israelites. In Egypt, they were called Hebrews, Ivrim, and later on, they were called the nation of Israel. Jews came much later. And well, it's interesting to note when they arrived. Because for the time that they were in the land, which was 800 plus years, in the land of Israel, this was the nation of Israel. First, under the time of Shoftim, and later on, under the time of Melachim, they were now a nation of Israel. And it's interesting to discuss, what does a nation mean? In forgetting the English translation, does it mean to say that there's a land? Does it mean to say that there's a king? There's a debate in the Mefarshim as to what exactly Kahal, Am Yisrael, means. But whatever you call it, it disappeared to a certain degree. And why is that? Because we entered Golus. First, the northern tribes, then all the 10 tribes. There was first the Avar Yardane tribes, which disappeared. Then the northern tribes which disappeared to Assyria, and slowly but surely until the siege of Yerushalayim, then there was exile. And for the first time in Jewish history now you have this nation which in a certain sense was reversing. Now you're regressing. So it's a nation, but it no longer has, you'll call it a king, It no longer has sovereignty. It no longer has a state. So what is it at this point in time? What happened to this chosenness of the nation of Israel when it no longer has the space to exist like another nation? That's, by the way, where we see the name Jewish suddenly appearing. Where's the first time we're seeing it? Israeli Megillas Esther. We talk about Yehudim. Esther is set, the whole drama is set in Persia, in the diaspora. Now, the name Yehudi is we'll call it an echo from the time of there was a state called Judea, which was the southern kingdom, which was left after the Assyrian exile. That's what happens. Now we start seeing Yehudim. Jew, in a certain sense, is a goddess term, is an exile term, which we start seeing being used in the diaspora sense, right in Megillas Esther. So what happens to the nation of Israel? So there's a very important ma'aral that we need to learn together. This ma'aral is very important to understanding the thought process of who we are today. And let's learn this, because we just have to appreciate how profound this idea is. This is to be found on page 7. We know we skipped the Derech Hashem, the Ksava Kabbalah for right now. This is just for further readings about nationhood. The ma'aral says in Netzach Yisrael Perek Ches, an insight which is very hard to read. It's very hard to read this, in this emotionally, to appreciate this. But nonetheless, it's a truth which accompanies us throughout existence. He says the following. By the way, I put a line between each of the paragraphs because these are each new pages. Okay, this is the Hartman edition. So there's actually footnotes. So most of the pages are footnotes. We're going to focus on the Maral himself, and we're starting on the top paragraph in the left-hand column, where it says V'ka'amar. We've all heard this Chazal. V'ka'amar b'tisha ba'av, shebachu b'chia shel chinam, v'akadosh baruch hu kava oisa b'chia l'dayros. We've all heard this. They cried in their tents for nothing on Tisha B'Av. So Hashem says, you cried for nothing, I'm going to make you cry for all generations. So we all think that's a little rap on the knuckles, right? Crying, right? It's much more than that. He says the following. Inyan ze amok ma'od ma'od. This is a very deep concept. Notice he put the word ma'od in there twice. Okay? Ki ka'asher ha'tziyam me'eretz Mitzrayim ha'tziyam al-manas vaseis la'alohim ha'aretz. The nation of Israel was supposed to move from point A to point B. Point A was Egypt. Point B was Eretz Canaan, therefore to be named Eretz Israel. That was the point. V'ilu ba'u oisam shi'otu mi'mitzrayim el-aretz. If those who left the land, left Egypt, had entered the land of Israel, their definition would have been as being part of the nation of Israel in the land of Israel. I explain this in Gvuras Hashem, focusing on Pesach. The leaving of Egypt was an infinite, an eternal moment. From that moment, we are the nation of Israel. If it was one movement from Egypt to the land of Canaan, if it was the same generation, it would be as if there was the one definitional moment of us being the nation of Israel, the land of Israel. We would be defined as being a nation state. We would be the nation of Israel in the land of Israel. That would be inextricable from our identity were that to have happened. We'll call it Plan A. However, he says, "Ubishvil shebachu bechiyah shel chinam, because they cried for nothing, v'lerotzo lichnos la'aretz, and that generation did not want to. They empathized with the claims of the Meraglim and did not want to enter the land. V'nishba kodesh baruch hu shelo yavi oisam l'dor la'aretz. That generation was precluded from entering the land. Rak dor acher, only the next generation. V'oz hayo nechlak hayatziyah mimitzrayim minabiyah la'aretz v'lohoyo ma'isa echad." There were different generations. One generation left, one generation came. It wasn't A to B, it was A to B to C. B was the desert. Therefore, v'davka hayatziyah nitzchis, and therefore only leaving Egypt was an eternal formulation, mitam asher ba'arnu b'chibur gvuras Hashem, sh'oz al yedei nisim v'niflo'oz yotzim mi'managoy shel olam, l'kach yinitzchis, it was supernatural, therefore it was eternal, v'loikach b'yotzom el aretz, v'davar zeh yesh lo'y bitul v'hefsek. And therefore, our entering into the land was not eternal. It was more natural, and therefore, it became something which was negotiable. says the Maharal. He goes on to explain this. Think about this for a second. So let's go back to the Chazal that he was commenting on. The spies cried and they caused a crying in the camp for nothing. So Hashem says, I'm going to cause a crying for a generation. What does he really mean to say? What is the Midrash really telling us? It's telling us that being in the land is not intrinsic to your identity. And therefore, there are going to come times where you're not going to be living in the land of Israel and you'll still be, so to speak, the nation who left Egypt. But you won't be the nation who intrinsically deserves to be in the land of Israel. That's what shifted then. Our identity was being decided at this point in time. That's what the Maharal says was happening. That's what the sin of the Chet HaMeraglim was. It wasn't just a rap on the knuckles. It was our very identity where that was at stake. Which means that in that moment that we cried and we thought maybe it's not worth going into the land of Israel and living in this type of existence, we ultimately chose a track in history which we are found in right now. For 1949 years, since the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, till this year, we have been a nation without a state. And now, actually, we should do a little bit of the math, actually, in the last few years and come back to recent times in just a moment. But ultimately, we've been the wandering Jew. How could that exist? Because we chose it. We chose that it was not going to be A to B, it was going to be A to B to C. That's what the Maharal says. And that's how we live. And in fact, it's interesting, if you do the math, there is more time spent at this point in time in Jewish history after entering the land of Israel, out of the land of Israel, deficient and missing most of the mitzvos, hatuluyos ba'aretz, than there was actually in the land of Israel. That's a shattering revelation. And this is stemming from this original initial decision that we made when we decided to listen to those meraglim. I'd like to give one example of the power of the magnitude of that, of this expression. And here's how it goes. So what we're trying to do is we're going to focus on the idea of being a nation outside of being a state. How have we existed for these last millennia? Here's an example. The Gemara, the Torah in Parshas Bechukos tells us, "Va'nisharim ba'her b'chem." There's all the curses. "Va'vesi morech bilvavom ba'artzos avayhem v'radafos some kol oleni dofa nosum enusascher v'noflu ve'in roidav." Terrible curse. We're going to be running from our own shadows. We're going to be running at every rustling in the leaves because we're so scared. And this has been our fate for so many years. We're going to fall over each other as if we're running from the sword and there's no one chasing us. We'll be so paranoid as the Jews. I remember Rabbi Jonathan Sacks once said that his father, he quoted his father, he says, "My father said, you know, a red traffic light stopped you and he said it was anti-Semitic, right?" So we're going to run and there's not going to be anybody there because we're so scared, because we've had so much persecution relentlessly through the ages. We're going to live in this constant state of flight. The Sifra says a very fascinating thing here. Sifra says, we learn a fascinating halacha over here. Not just a halacha, actually we'll call it a truth about the nation of Israel. The Sifra, the Midrash Halacha says over here in Bechukosai, V'koshel ish ba'achiv, v'eno emer ish ba'achiv, elo ish ba'avonachiv. It says that the Chazal darshan out that it means that we're going to be tripping not over each other's legs, but over each other's sins. Milamein shekol Yisrael arevim zebozeh. This teaches us that all of Israel are arevim zebozeh. And this has halachic nafkemina. As an example, let's say you do Kiddush and Shul, or you do Kiddush in one house. You can come home and do it in Kiddush in your house as long as there's somebody there who's not been Yotze yet. Why? Because Kol Yisrael Arevim Yotze Moitze, as long as you've not been Yotze Yochiev, my Chiev is deficient, I can be Moitze you when it comes to a lot of these halachos. Not in Birkas Hanen, but in Birkas HaMitzvos, we view it as there's a certain sense of Arvus, which means that connects us. We all have this guarantorship for each other. That's the way it seems to work. Here's the question. The question is could there not be a better place to learn this from? Meaning like, there are many times in the Torah, you know, Ish echad belev echad har Sinai. Right, that should be the place where we learn. The Chazal say, there's this notion called Arvus, there's this guarantorship, and therefore, here we have pandemonium. Here we have anarchy. Here we have paranoia. And this is where Chazal decide to learn the notion of Arvus from. How is that? So it's fascinating. It's fascinating. This is one of the most remarkable insights. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has a book called To Heal a Fractured World. It was a book which I knew must have existed my whole life. And it just took me the time to find the book. You know that something must exist. It's about Judaism and its relationship to the world as a whole. Just a remarkable gift to Judaism, that sefer. If anybody has the chance to read it, it's not easy, but it's very worthwhile. And he has a very interesting insight in the book, which says the following, and that is that here the problem was that when we went into exile, that moment in time, our very identity was at stake. There was a question as to whether we could any longer be the nation of Israel. Could we carry on being an entity which has significance anymore? Were we still chosen when ultimately Hashem threw us out of what looked like was the plan? And that's it's a very important question which was asked. In the words of, in the most more complex words of Spinoza, who was no friend to the Jews ultimately, was a complex individual, a very complex individual. Listen to his argument over here. Listen to the heresy for a second. Here's what he says. But with regard to the ceremonial observances which were ordained in the Old Testament for the Hebrews only, and were so adapted to their state that they could, for the most part, only be observed by the society as a whole and not by each individual, it is evident that they form no part of the divine law and had nothing to do with the blessedness and virtue, but had reference only to the election of the Hebrews, that is, to the temporal, bodily happiness and tranquility of their kingdom, and that therefore they were only valid while that kingdom lasted. Meaning, let's open Sefer Vayikra for a second, says Spinoza, and you read about the Karbanos. Well, in Babylon, in Rome, in Europe, we don't have the Karbanos. So what's the point of it all, says Spinoza? Didn't it all fall flat when we lost that? Doesn't the Torah talk about the promises of going to the land of Israel and all the mitzvahs there? So when they disappear, what's left? And by the way, he wasn't the only one to ask this. This was asked by the Jews themselves. When we go to Yechezkel, Perek Chof, Yechezkel, who is the prophet who lives where? In Babylon himself. He was exiled as a young man to Babylon, to Nar Kvar, up in the Middle East, further north in the area of Syria and Iraq today. And there he has the prophecies. He talks about a group of individuals that come to him, and this is what they say in Source 13, Yechezkel, Perek Chof, Pasuk Lamed Vez, Va'ayla, Al Ruchachem, Haloi, Loi Siyeh. What you are claiming to me will never be, he says. Asher atem amrim niyak ha-goyim k'mishpachos ha-ratzos l'shareis eitz ha-even. You say you want to serve the nations, the pagan nations of the world. That will never be. Why are they saying this? The Gemara adds in the subtext to this complaint in Source 14. This is what the Gemara says in Sanhedrin Kufhei. Amrulai, they said to Yechezkel, what was their claim which he is denying the veracity of? Eved shemachu rabbi, v'isha shegir shabala, klum yesh ze lazel ze klum. A slave has been rejected. A spouse has been divorced. Is there a relationship worth talking about afterwards? What are they saying? The first generation of exilees who are now moving to Babylon are saying to Yechezkel, what's it all about? Is there anything which can continue? That was the question they were raising. And it's a very valid question. It's a question you can understand. If you were in their shoes, you would probably raise yourself. A very complex question. Is there such a thing as the nation of Israel when we no longer have the land of Israel? When we no longer have sovereignty, monarchy, statehood? Not so simple. Which is why precisely, and this is the brilliance of it, is where is it that we learn the notion of arvus, that there is a guarantorship, that we care about each other, but not just care about each other, that so to speak we are halachically interconnected to the point that I can do a mitzvah on your behalf when you are deficient in it, on your behalf. Yotza Moitzi, how do I know that? Where is it learnt out of? Parashas Bechukosai, where? Where everybody is running into exile. What Chazal is saying is, yes, we lost a whole lot. But no, we did not lose our identity. And there's a shift which is happening over here, and this is a very hard shift to understand, is the movement from a state nation into a religious nation, so to speak. They were always religious. This wasn't invented. But the point is, the focus now became our interconnectedness, our arvus, our we'll call it our practice, which is what happens if you fast forward then a few hundred years later, when this happens all over again. When the nation of Israel is now exiled the second time, in the year 70, the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, the year 135, in the destruction of, in the Hadrianic persecutions, and the crushing of the revolt of Bar Kokhba, we see the same thing happening again. As an example, famous Gemara in Gittin, the Gemara tells us, this is in Source 17, the Gemara tells us, Nun Vavam obeys, when Rabbi Yochanan managed to slip out of the city and meet Vespasian, before Vespasian receives a promotion, he asks for three things. And what is one of those three things? Think about what that request means for a second. That means to say that now we're losing the centrality of Yerushalayim. We're sacrificing whether we had the choice or not. And there's a debate whether he should have asked for more. He is, in a certain sense, has lost the centrality of Yerushalayim. And is now, what is the centrality going to be? The sages and the best in the Torah. That's why the Gemara in Brachos says, if you take a look over the page, Brachos Chesem and Aleph, Amalei Hachi Amar Rav Chista, Ma'adich Siv Ol Hashem Eshar Yitzir Mikol Mishkanos Yaakov, that it says that Hashem loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwelling places of Yaakov. Oyev Hashem Sh'orim HaMetzuyonim Ba'alocha Yosem Yibotah Knesset Yibotah Midrashos. Where's Hashem to be found? In the Sh'orim HaMetzuyonim Ba'alocha. In the realm of Halacha, as the Gemara continues, V'ayinu Domer Bichia Barami Mishmei Da'ula, Miyom Shechar Beis HaMikdash, Ein Loi La'akodesh Baruch Hu Bo'elamoi, Elo Arbo Amos Shal Halacha Bilvad. From the time the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, we lose what it means to be, we'll call it a classic nation. We lose the nationhood, the ability to be able to perform mitzvahs in pristine. And a large amount of the mitzvahs we lose. At that point in time, where's HaKodesh Baruch Hu found? In the Dalet Amos Shal Halacha, in the realm of Halacha. And that's why, starting already at the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, at the times of Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, we see a proliferation. Not that it wasn't there before, but we see expounding of this part, one of the three parts of Torah Sheval Peh, as the Rambam describes, as there's now the construction, after seeing what Golus did first time around, now there's a construction of, we'll call it what is known as Rabbinic Judaism. Rabbinic Judaism existed before, and there was Torah Sheval Peh all the time. But the expansion of the rules, the Gedarim, the Siyagim, the Takonos, the Drashos, now expanded to create a system. A system of law which would now accompany us through every single country which we were exiled to and expelled from and tortured in, and would still maintain who we are. And there's this shift, so to speak, where the focus now no longer becomes Judaism as a state, Israel as a nation in the state of Israel. Now we're moving into the Knesset Yisrael in its so-called more undercover version, where we are separated by language, culture, years, but we're still held together by the very inner core, which is the Torah. Now, good. You're right. So, correct. So it's interesting. So I didn't have a chance to read this, but if you take a look back in Source 16, the collected writings of Rav Hirsch, that's exactly his point. So he says that's why at the times at the end of the second the Golus of Babylon into Persia, that's why Haman's focus was not on national ethnicity, but on religious observance, because that was what was kept us together. Now, if we're in all the 127 states of the Persian Empire, what was it that held us together was not the nation state, but our identity as Dasehem Shonas Mikolam. And that's what happens. In Achinamim, we don't have time to go into this today, but we did learn to a little while back together the M.S. Liakov, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who, quoting the Ramban, understands that even the second Commonwealth, even the second Beis HaMikdash, was in a state of Golus. It was the waiting chamber for the Golus of Edom, and that's why a number of the precautions were made as to prepare us, having seen the Babylonian exile, after knowing that the Aron was not there, after knowing that the Shechina was not back, after Nevuah was ceasing. That was when the second Beis HaMikdash, even during that time, was already moving towards that, because of the loss of what we call the Kingdom of Israel, and that in the classical sense, as well we have it. In fact, this is what historians point out as well. Just interesting, I came across this just reading over the last few days in the History of Israel by John Bright. He says, but this redefinition of Israel meant inevitably the emergence of a religion in which law was central. This betokened, let it be repeated, this is in Source 19, no break from Israel's ancient faith. We weren't recreating ourselves, right? All the major features which continued in force, but a radical regrouping of that faith about law. The law no longer merely regulated the affairs of an already constituted community, it created the community, right? Beforehand, what made us who we are is we lived in the land of Israel, we were in the nation of Israel. Now, that isn't the case. So what is it that keeps us together is the Torah and the law. As an example, by in Paul Johnson's The History of the Jews, on the next page in Source 20, The second consequence of the final failure of the state of Judaism was the profound change in the nature and scope of Jewish activities. From 70 AD and still more after 135 AD, Judaism ceased to be a national religion in any physical and visible sense, and the Jews were depatriated. Instead, both Jewry and Judaism became coextensive with the study and observance of Torah. It is difficult to fit Jewish history into any general taxonomy of national and religious development because it is a unique phenomenon. Indeed, the historian of the Jews is constantly faced with the problem of categorizing a process of which there is no other example anywhere. That's exactly the point we're dealing with now in the executive order in the last week. That's exactly what he's saying. The concentration of Judaism and the Jewish nation on the Torah had proceeded steadily since the last phase of the Davidic kingdom, the reforms of Yeshayahu, the exile, return of the exile, the work of Ezra, the triumph of the Maccabees, the rise of Phariseeism, that's the Purushim, and the synagogue, the schools, the rabbis. All these developments in turn had first established, then progressively consolidated the absolute dominance of the Torah in the Jewish religious social life. It had, in doing so, emasculated the other institutions of Judaism and Jewry. Fascinating. And again, that doesn't mean to say that this did not exist before, and as the Rambam says, Torah Shebaal Peh was always there along the way, just as the traditions. But the other aspects of the drashos, the expansion, was what is being referred to over here. So this is what the movement that we see. Now that leads us to 2,000 years of exile, and Baruch Hashem, we successfully, although having lost many to those who killed us and many to those who we decided to join, we're still here. And we're still here at the end of these almost 2,000 years, and we still have successfully been the nation of Knesset Israel. However, the question now arises in our day and age. Because we are living at a remarkable state, at a remarkable moment in Jewish history, where we've seen, in a certain sense, the starting of the reversal of this process itself. Let's take a quick look at this. The Gra says, this is a beautiful passage of the Gra, which is found in the Tzafrat Zitzniusa at the back, in the Likutim in Likut Yud. He says the following. Source 21, by the period towards the end of the first line, he says, Ki Yecheskel, Omar Bederech Chida, Yecheskel had a parable. He was already in the diaspora at the end of the Beis HaMikdash. We don't really know exactly what it means, but he says the Gra, ki me'esh shachar ba'is yotzer ruchenu ataras roshenu v'nisharnu rak anachnu hu guf shela b'loy nefesh. We remain, as so to speak, a body without a soul, says the Vilna Gaon, after the distraction. V'yetzir l'chutz l'aretz hu ha-kever, entering the diaspora was entering the grave. V'rima mesuveves olenu, and slowly the biodegrading process began. And we're not able to save our souls from those who start consuming us from the outside. And there were still the central locations of yeshivas, where we had the major places, let's say Pumpedissa, Masa Machasya, the great places of the yeshivas, the centralization of Jewish leadership. Until all the flesh rotted away, and the bones got scattered of Israel from place after place. But the bones still existed. So there was no longer the central form of the nation, as we'll call the skeletal structure. Until even the bones started disintegrating and all that was left was dust. And we at the end of Jewish history, he says, are the dust of the bones of the body that was scattered in the diaspora. And that's why we say on Friday night, quoting the Pasuk in Yeshayahu, Hisnaari me offer kumi. Bring me up from the dust, because all that's left is the dust. There's no structure, there's no body, there's no content to that body. What is he referring to? By the way, what's the metaphor that he's using? He's directly focusing on the prophecy in Yechezkel, Perek Lamed Zayin. A very emotional prophecy, we read it as Haftarah, but sometimes we don't focus on just how powerful is Haftarah on Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach. And we don't appreciate just how powerful this is. Let's read a few psukim in that expression of Yechezkel. He's taken to this valley, And he's now shown these bones, which the Pasuk emphasizes are yiveishos ma'oid. They're very dry. Vayomer Eli, and Hashem says to the prophet at the bottom of page 22, Isaiah 22, Ben Adam, son of man, ha'tichieno ha'atzamoy sa'ele. Will they ever live? Will these bones scattered around the valley live? Vayomer Hashem Elokim, atoyodata. Hashem, you only know. Vayomer Eli, hinovel ha'atzamoy sa'ele. Prophesize to these bones. Vamart alihem ha'atzamos yaveshos shimu dvar Hashem. Listen to the word of Hashem. Komar Hashem ha'atzamos ha'ele. Hinei ani mevi b'chem ruach v'yichisem. I'm going to bring a spirit and it's going to bring you a life. V'nosat alechem gidim. I'm going to put sinews in you. V'aleisi alechem basar. And flesh will grow on those sinews and bones. V'karamti alechem or. And I will spread skin over that structure. V'nosati b'chem ruach v'yichisem v'yidatem ki ani Hashem. Vini Basi says Yecheskel, I gave the prophecy, Kasher Tzuvaisi, as I was commanded. Vayiko Kinovi, there was a loud sound as I gave this prophecy. Vine Rash, Vatikruvu Atzomois Etzem El Atzmoi. And now the bones started coming slowly towards one another. Vrayisi, Vine Alehem Gidim, Ubosor Allah, Vayikram Alehem Or Milamala Varuach Ein Bohem. And now the skin covered the bones and the flesh. But they could not breathe yet. Vayomer Eli, hinovel ruach, speak to the wind or to the spirit. Hinove ben adam v'amarte el ruach, komar Hashem Elokim, me'ar baruch es boi ruach, ufoichi barugim ho'ele v'ichyu, and breathe into these deceased and they will live. Vayinebeisi kashet zivani, v'tavo boem ruach v'ichyu v'amdu al ragleim chayil godol mo'od mo'od. And all these dead, deceased bodies, these corpses stood up and lived again. Vayomer Eli, Ben Adam, Hatzamois Hayaveshois, or Ele, Korbeis Yisrael Hema. These bones are the nation of Israel. Hine Omrim, Yavshu Atzmoisenu, Vavdosik Fosenu, Nigzaralon, Nigzarnulanu. They say our bones are dry, it's the end, we've been cut off. Those are the people who came to Yecheskel and Perikhof. This is the same Yecheskel. He's speaking to that same audience. He says, "Locheni no bevo marta lehem komar Hashem Elokim. Hinei ani poseches kivreichem v'aloisiyeschem imkivroisechem. Ami, I'm going to bring you out of your graves, my people." By the way, when Naftali Hertz Imber was creating Atikva, he brought it from this pasuk in pasuk Yud Aleph. When they said "Avdo tikvoseinu," then he reformed that as "Oid loy avdo tikvoseinu" was actually from this pasuk in Yecheskel. Nonetheless, this is the most miraculous prophecy. Let's go back to the Vilna Gaon for a second. The Vilna Gaon says that when we went into the land, when we went out of the land of Israel, we in a certain sense entered the grave. And yes, for a little while, we did have centrality and sovereignty of controls for a certain degree, but slowly that got broken up. The flesh got disintegrated. The leadership disappeared. The structure got broken up. There was no longer centrality. We moved from as flotsam and jetsam across history and place and time. Kicked out of France 6 times, exiled from England 350 years. Let's understand Jewish history. And all that's left at the end is just simply these strewn bones and dust, even, says the Vilna Gaon at the end of history. That's where we are. That's how far it's come. And the only thing that's holding us together is the Torah. The only thing that possibly holds us together is the Torah. And now comes the end of history. Can I hold the question for the end? Is that right? I want to get a little bit of acceleration over here. Now, which means to say, what we are witnessing at this time, at this point in time, in Jewish history, which we are extremely privileged and blessed to be living in, is we're slowly watching this process happen. Where are we on the process? We don't know whether the Ruach has returned or not. The bones are certainly coming towards each other. The institutions of Jewish life as a nation are returning to be what it was to a certain degree. We're not there. We're certainly not there. But this is the beginning of the process that we're witnessing, which gives rise to a lot of questions. He has an example of one question which was raised. This is a question which was raised in 1958. By the Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion. And he asked the following question. He had a problem. The problem was the following. Is that the nation, the state of Israel, was a state, a democratic state like all others. But, on the one hand, there were certain citizens that were supposed to also be the Jewish state, which is still a debate today as to how to put those two together. And there was one advantage and one uniqueness that a Jew has living in the state of Israel. And that is, that if you were Jewish, you had the right of return. Any Jew in the world has the right of return to the state of Israel. What a remarkable, remarkable thing which has saved thousands, hundreds of thousands of lives in the last 70 years. Now, the problem is it's not so easy to define who is a Jew. Because the case he raises as a question is, let's say you now have a family, which is assimilated, intermarried. So you have the mother who is non-Jewish, the father is Jewish, they have children who, legally, halachically, are non-Jewish, but the parents both say, we want our child to be considered Jewish. So we'll sort of ethnically, nationally, we want them to be considered nationalistically a Jew, but not religiously a Jew. Can that exist? Can the state of Israel stamp that passport? Can the state of Israel write on that person's identity document, Jew? Complicated. And he sent this letter, he sent us a 5-page letter, which I actually included in the source, I'm not going to read it now. He sent us as a letter to all the thought leaders in the land of Israel and the diaspora. And he received many, many responses. And it's fascinating to read through them. I mean, we're talking about people the like of Rav Aaron Kotler, Rav Soloveitchik, the Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote 2 letters back to him. It's fascinating. The Lubavitcher wrote a letter in answer, and he sent a second letter saying, you know, you have a responsibility and a privilege to be the prime minister, and he encouraged him to make the state more religious. It was unbelievable to read the words of all these leaders across the spectrum. Fascinating. And ultimately, predominantly for anybody who was schooled in Jewish thought, anybody, all the leaders who actually had a connection to traditional Judaism, even those who weren't, said the following. He has the response of Rav Soloveitchik, who responded with Rav Chaim Heller. At the bottom of the next page, it says 116 and 117. This is dated the 25th of Shvat, 5179. And this is from when Rav Soloveitchik, from his residence in Massachusetts, in Boston. He says, "Honorable Sir, each of us, the undersigned, received a separate letter from you. Since, however, our opinions with reference to the question posed coincide, we have decided to render one halachic communication instead of 2 separate versions. The questions pertaining to the registration of children born from non-Jewish non-Jewish mothers who have not been fittingly converted according to the halacha needs no further probing. There exist 2 basic halachos which have been transmitted to us from the time immemorial, and which have become very pillars of Jewish tradition. These set forth the unequivocal answer. The first halacha is, the offspring of a non-Jewish bears the same status as herself. The second halacha is, a non-Jew who is circumcised but has not had ritual immersion, tevilah, or who has been ritually immersed but not circumcised is not to be recognized as a convert to Judaism until he has been both circumcised and ritually immersed. In other words, the mother establishes a child's sanctity and the status of belonging to or identification with the Jewish people. True and proper conversion is gained only by the means of circumcision immersion for a male and through ritual immersion alone for a female. Hence, it is impossible for any person, minor or adult, to be considered or registered as a Jew if the mother is non-Jewish, as long as he himself has not been converted to Judaism." And he goes on, he quotes the Rambam, and then he says at the second last paragraph on the right, "We are indeed perplexed that the state of Israel now seeks to hew down our traditional branches and thereby smear an ancient glory of Israel, which has long been sanctified through the spilt blood of suffering and sufferings of preceding generations. It is only because of these roots that we preserve our uniqueness as a holy people and that we are inexorably bound to the Holy Land. We therefore ask you, Your Excellency, you whose name we honor and whose historic accomplishments for the establishment of the State of Israel we acknowledge, will the present State of Israel be built up by maintaining a threat of destruction to its very sanctity?" Now, this is a very strong letter, and there's many. It's really worthwhile reading the entire book. It's published to read all the responses. But in a certain sense, I think that the question was the wrong question. Now, the reason why the state of Israel needed to ask this question, because it was a pressing issue. And there were lots of interesting suggestions. Maybe call these people Hebrews. Maybe just give their nationality, not Judaism. It's a complex issue. But the question that he was asking was for a person who's halachically not Jewish, whether they could be called Jewish. And the answer is no. There's just no way. That doesn't work that way. However, I think that the question we should be asking is a little bit shifted to the side. But you see, the reason why this question's arriving is because now we have a nation state. Can we have the notion of what's called an Israeli, or a Jew who, so to speak, is devoid of the religious accoutrements? That's the question that he's raising, essentially. But I think the question is more subtle. And the question he should have been raising, or we should really be thinking about ourselves, is now that we have a Jewish state, now that we have a nation, so to speak, a place for the nation of Israel, is there a notion of a person who may be halachically Jewish, but not observant of Torah, of which there are many, and can we call that person, so to speak, Israeli as a separate entity as Jewish, so to speak? Meaning, if you think about this, there are people in the diaspora who have assimilated to the point that even though they themselves may know or believe They are no longer part of the fold. In Israel, we now have a notion of people who are no longer observant, and they for generations now have not had any semblance of religiosity, but they are Israelis and ultimately Jews. We now see the work, in a certain sense, the return of this nationhood of Israel as opposed to just the religion of Israel, something which has never existed beforehand in a maintained generation to generation enterprise. Why is this important? Is because this is exactly what we're witnessing now. It is true that when you read the responses to the executive order last week, there are many Americans who are upset about it. Why are they upset about it? Because for the Americans, they feel that there's a dual nationality, right? In a certain sense, are we Jews or are we Americans? But in the larger sense, there is now a nation called the State of Israel, and there's a group of people called Israelis. And the Jews in diaspora have not yet, in a certain sense, they struggle with who our identity really is. Are we Israelis as part of the nation of Israel? Are we Jews like the diaspora exile Jew of the last 2,000 years? And slowly, slowly over time, we are seeing the shift, the gravity, the center of gravity is moving back towards Israel. Whether it be even in the modality of music. Music is slowly, even in diaspora, becoming more Hebrew and Israeli. Slowly our culture is shifting back towards the nation. The bones are coming together, even though they may not have the ruach yet in some of them. There's a notion of something else which is happening here. The nation is reforming. The way it's expressed in the book Tal Aleichem, which is actually was really authored by the student of Rav Chaim Cohen, who is Rav Ruvain Sasson. In a remarkable piece, he calls what he calls the Moichin de Katnus Shababi Zman Agolus. He says the following: when we're in Golos, it's like we're asleep, so to speak. What does it mean asleep? Is the human being dead? No. The human being is alive. There's certain brain functions which are still operative. But they're not fully functional. Not fully functional. So he says the following. The top of column 2. Vinei. On this is on source 24 towards the end, page 15. Vinei inyan chayus mitzumtzemes zu. This, so to speak, this asleep aliveness at the period during exile. Zu he soid moichin de katnus. This is the idea of what we'll call the small-mindedness. Hatoomim, right? Hatoomim es matzavenu begalus, which is our diaspora reality. Shubachinas his parados aguf le'risisim, which is the body being broken into pieces, like the grass said. Umoichin elu hem chios shel risisim anefradim, and these little pieces live alone. V'heim lemaase hashoresh letfisas achaim la'avodas Hashem b'meshech yimei agalus, and that is how we live. Shehi avodas Hashem shall kol teh shekeshu levado la'atzmoi. Every cell, every unit of Judaism lives independently. This community, that community center, this shul, this country, every little group of Jews are their own entity. Ki hinei achayos shelanu hi bevadai avodas Hashem. Our real, at the core, our service is serving Hashem. Shehi machaberes asanu ele ov yisporach, which is what pulls us together to serve Him. Umamshicha banu chayim v'kiyum, and that's what gives us life. Umeshach galus lo yochlo liskalos banu madregos achayim agdola shel aguf kuloi. But we've never been able to talk the language of the body, only the cells, only the pieces. This digit of Klal Yisrael is in France. This arm is in Germany, but never the body as a whole. And therefore there's a little bit left on each little individual piece. And so he goes on to say, and therefore that's why when we speak, we talk languages of individuality. We as Jews are interested as ourselves as individuals, and we're certainly living in an acutely individualistic society. But even our community functions are individualistic. There's no notion of, we'll call it international Jewry. There are a few inspirational individuals who think like this. Most of us are taking care of our Dalet Amos, and that is a function of Golus. There are moments in time where we start feeling what's called Moichin de Gadlus, you know, when the three boys were kidnapped and we all felt that connection. When Gilad Shalit was returned. There's a few moments in time where we experience what we call the national expression of we as opposed to I or community. We talk about nation. But for the vast majority of Jewish history of the last 2,000 years, it's been ta'im nefradim, different cellular existences separately. Just an example of what we're witnessing now. And by the way, this does not mean to say it comes with religious accompaniment necessarily. The first stages, as Rav Kook talks about, The first stages are the bones connecting to each other, muscles. The ruach isn't there yet. But it's the first necessary stage in order for the ruach to actually infuse those bodies with life. I'd like to just quote one last story just as an example. To me, it's a very powerful example. Actually, Michael gave this book to me a little while back called Pumpkin Flowers, which is written by Marty Friedman, an ex-Canadian Israeli. Really a very powerful book. He wrote the Aleppo Codex, for those who are interested. This is another book. Pumpkin Flowers. Pumpkin was a base, the code name of a base in Lebanon. Between the time when Israel returned its troops to Israel, they maintained a number of bases in that strip above, up to the Litani River. They had a number of bases. The code name of one of those bases was called Pumpkin. Flowers is the code name of those who are injured. Okay, so now Pumpkin Flowers is the code name of those who were injured around the base. And he served as a soldier in this time, the 90s. This is, remember, the helicopter crashes, right? So that was the ending of a certain period of that time. And most people forget the stage. They were out there essentially surrounded by the Hezbollah, trying to kill him every single night. And the reason they were there was to preserve the security, which they managed to do. Remarkably, because when they pulled back, that's when Hezbollah started shooting rockets and digging tunnels into Israel proper, right? But many, many lives were lost there. He talks about, he's not a religious person himself per se, but he talks about a combatant, a friend of his, whose name was Iran. And Iran was a religious Zionist soldier. He was a Dati Le'umi soldier. And to the degree that he was able to, this was his perspective on life. In the last page, in page 25, Pumpkin Flowers, page 48. Iran brought the pamphlet to the outpost. He's talking about the things that he would learn, kept it in his webbing, and read it when he could. Sitting on the old soil mattresses under fluorescent lights, sneaking a cigarette in the yard between tasks, flicking the ash between his scuffed boots. He divided the men at Pumpkin into two groups. The ones trying to do the minimum and to make it home safe, and the idealists, who are committed to something larger than themselves. In hours spent arguing with the others about this, he forged the following conclusion. He was there not for himself, not for the respect he received when he returned home, not even for his friends. He was there for the country. This was the highest altruism he could imagine from where he stood. He volunteered for everything. This is Iran. A few months into his service, there was suspicious activity. The Pumpkin was on top of a hill. They noticed suspicious activity on the edge of the woods, which is the nearby town. And of course, as the media will fail constantly to recognize, there's not a shot which is fired without consulting the legal team. They called up the legal team in Israel and they said, we noticed suspicious activity, but it was ambiguous through their night vision, and they received a negative. They could not shoot. It was too ambiguous to shoot upon these terrorists. They were denied this and the attack came. They were terrorists. And this is the description of the attack, just to understand how powerful it is. The guerrillas disappeared. When the shells fell at 5:59 a.m., Iran thought he saw a few heads peeking from behind the boulders downhill. He fired at them and saw puffs of dust nearby. Then he was on his knees. He couldn't breathe. Something had flashed and something was burning. He looked down and saw his right arm was no longer attached to his body, but remained in the sleeve of his coat. He dragged himself out of the guard post into the trench, where he found himself looking at someone's boots. Help me, Iran said. Two soldiers found him in charred and delirious. They put a tourniquet on his stump and carried him to one of the bunkers, which by some magic appeared to have assumed the size of an auditorium, so he remembers. They laid him on the floor between the beds. A medic named Davidoff gave him a shot in the thigh, morphine. Iran felt he had to scream. He just needed to get it out of him. So he screamed and screamed, and then he said, I'm sorry. And they radioed, and they took care of the terrorists. And he goes on the next paragraph. He says, the lookout now was now motionless, a motionless human shape under a gray blanket. He was 20 years old. A few months earlier, before heading to Pumpkin for the first time, Amir had written a neat hand on a yellow pad. In a few days, I'll be on my way to another outpost. It is the road that might be one way, it might not be. His mother found the note afterwards. When the helicopter landed in Israel, men in white smocks rushed Iran through the sliding doors into an emergency room. A TV cameraman filmed him going past. In the footage, you'll see an altruist's face, blackened and unrecognizable. You hear him screaming something as he passes. If you pay attention, you can make out the words, for the country. Think about that for a second. Never in the last 2,000 years have we ever been able to do that. Ever. Well, what's happening over here is we're witnessing, slowly but surely, Yechezkel's idea of the return into something bigger. Bigger than the Moichim Dakatnos of survival in each individual diaspora city. Into, yes, the return of a nation. To the return of a national consciousness. Into the return of national language. That we can talk about greater ideals than ourselves. So yes, it's a long journey ahead. And the Ruach still has yet to come. But we need to make sure that the guf, that the body comes together. And we appreciate this moment in history. Thank you very much.
ויחנן מהקש שומר הצג לוש ברוך הוא לזכויס אס ישראל לפיך חיר בעלו עם תורה מיצר שני מהרדוני חווה צמן ציקו יגדיל תורה ויעדיר.